This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our topic today was getting away with murder. Snapshot of Chicago. Our panelists included Tribune reporters Jeremy Gorner, Will Lee, Annie Sweeney, and our moderator was Angela Rosas O'Toole, the deputy metro editor of the Chicago Tribune. Today's program focuses in on a weekend in August of 2018, when 75 people were shot in the city of Chicago. 13 were killed. There were 40 incidences in a seven-hour period. 40 people were wounded in that seven-hour period. Only four people have been charged with any of those shootings. So the panelists asked the questions of why. How do we get away with murder? They talked about gang warfare, poverty, terrified residents, police that are overworked and stymied. Fewer than 7% of the shootings in Chicago were solved in 2018. They look at the question of why is the clearance rate so abysmal? Why is Chicago's clearance rate pale in comparison to Los Angeles and New York City? The clearance rate means by arrest, where people are arrested and charged or cleared exceptional. Detectives have an idea, but no arrests can be made. The suspect could be dead. The victims could be uncooperative. In 2011, 49% of the murders were cleared in Chicago. 2017, 35%. Chicago is now well below the national average. Why was this such a violent period in Chicago's 2018 year? They talk about the themes at the root issues of crime, such as hard-to-find witnesses, people who won't say anything, people who are terrified, people who feel they just want to move on. They're resigned that in some areas there will always be shootings, stabbings, and high crime, a feeling in some cases that the police do not follow up. Many of the victims' families share disappointments in not getting contacted on a regular basis by the Chicago Police Department. Part of the problem is manpower, the reporters indicated. In 2009, there were 1,150 detectives in the city of Chicago. 2017, less than 900. The police department is committed for 2019 to add 350 more detectives and supervisors. Then we could talk about the state's attorney's office and the court process, a court system that handles 3,000 cases each year, with only 500 assistant state's attorneys and overworked public defenders. Problem solvers. Who cares most in these communities? All the reporters, interestingly, indicated it was women, moms. Moms push the hardest. They're the advocates for the victims. They constantly phone and contact the police department to see if there are any updates. The big question that has to be addressed is, when will the streets begin to talk to the police department, and when will the police department begin to talk to the street?
Thank you. I'd like to ask Jeremy and Annie and Will Lee to join me here. One person struck each hour, hit in the leg, the stomach, the arm, the back, the head. In fewer than 72 hours between Friday evening and Monday morning on the first weekend of August, 75 people were shot in the city of Chicago, an average of more than one person per hour. 13 of them were killed. It would be one of the most deadly weekends in Chicago. Bullets ricocheting on streets where gang warfare, poverty, and distrust of authorities have crippled communities, driven out residents, and stymied police. 5 months later, few people have been charged. Four. The Chicago Tribune has for years kept its own records of every shooting in our city, keeping track of thousands of people who've been felled by the violence. In recent years, the Chicago Police Department has struggled to solve those crimes. Fewer than 7% of shootings were solved in the same year, last year. Tribune editor Bruce Dold challenged our Metro desk to find out why. Why was Chicago's ability to solve crimes, known as the clearance rate, so abysmal, so far below the national average? So we focused on that first weekend of August, examining the shootings and the aftermath to tell that story. Our team of reporters sought out victims, tracked down case reports, interviewed police officers, detectives, tracked cases through the courts. The resulting stories, which could be found on our website, revealed the complex challenges that police face every day trying to solve crime, and also the ripple effect that that inability has on our community, our sense of safety, our future. So we have with us today three of those reporters: Will Lee, longtime crime reporter for the Chicago Tribune, who's been working on our overnight desk. He was a legman for the well-known John Cass and has a well-known Twitter handle called Midnoir Cowboy. You may follow him on Twitter. Annie Sweeney. I'm sorry, thank you. Annie Sweeney is a criminal justice reporter as well for the Chicago Tribune. She's been with us for more than a decade and was a reporter before that at the Chicago Sun-Times, where she also covered crime. She's won numerous awards as well. And Jeremy Gorner, who currently covers the Chicago Police Department and criminal justice issues. He's also been with us for more than a decade and was a former reporter for the City News Bureau. But they were led in this project by a number of editors, Dan Haar and Matt O'Connor in the audience with us. Dan and Matt, wait. And managing editor Peter Kendall, who helped push this project along as well. Project like this requires the talents of many, so I'd also like to name some of the reporters who also helped on this project. Madeline Buckley is with us. Rosemary Regina Sobel is also here. Thanks, Rose. And photographer Armando Sanchez was a key player in the series as well. Okay. Let's start out. Let's explain a few things. What does clearance rate mean?
Hello. Can you? Okay,
go ahead, Jeremy.
So, Chicago Police Department, they calculate clearance rate basically, you know, there's really two ways. There's cleared by arrest, which is pretty much the traditional way you and I think of when a crime is solved. Say there's a murder that occurs, somebody's arrested, somebody's charged. That's, by police department standards, that's a, you know, that case is cleared. Or a case is called cleared exceptional. Now, what that means basically is that the detectives have a pretty good idea who the suspect in the murder is, but for reasons beyond their control, despite exhausting all investigative measures, they're unable to make that arrest and see to it that there are charges. And that could happen for any number of reasons. It could be that, you know, for example, the suspect who they have in mind could be dead, or the victim in the case. I guess this really wouldn't apply to homicides, but for like a non-fatal shooting, the victim in the case, you know, is uncooperative. So that those are really like the main two ways for it.
Okay, so based on that information, what's the clearance rate in Chicago and how does that compare elsewhere?
So I just want to explain a few things about that. There's really two ways that the clearance rate is calculated in Chicago based on data that we receive from the police department, that we requested and received from the police department. There's what is called calendar year clearance and total clearance. So calendar year clearance basically is you take the number of murders that happened in a given year, and then you look at, of those murders, how many were solved. That's calendar year clearance. Total clearance is a little more complicated, but it is the national, it's the CPD standard, it's the national standard for police departments across the country. Total clearance, you're basically adding murders that were cleared that year that occurred in prior years. So, you know, basically, though, any way you splice it, Chicago's numbers are down. I mean, the national average, which is basically from the FBI and how they gather stats from police departments around the country, in 2017 it was hovering around 60%. So, just to give you some numbers, and I probably should have brought visual aids, but I'll do my best. Just for some perspective to give you an idea. So, calendar year clearance in 2011. And, you know, when Mayor Emanuel was elected, the calendar year clearance rate was around 29%. And that was a year where we had around 435 murders, give or take. So fast forward to 2017, that number was down to 17%, and that's the lowest calendar year clearance rate in recent memory in Chicago. So now if you look at total clearance, 2011, that number was around 49%. That number has really been fluctuating throughout the years. And then in 2017, it settled to around 35%. We did have numbers for 2018, we only had numbers like through the early part of September. And the calendar year clearance rate really didn't change. It was still around 17% at the time. But the total clearance did improve. It improved to around 41%. But anyway, you splice it, I mean, Chicago still is below that national average. And again, this is a fact that has been acknowledged by police officials, which is why there's, you know, help coming in from outside Chicago, from Los Angeles and from DC think tank, you know, that's trying to come up with a report about how to improve the Detective Bureau. We'll get into that a little later,
okay,
though.
Thanks, Jeremy. So let's take the audience to that first weekend in August. Can one of you explain what was going on in the city? What precipitated this large number of shootings and homicides? So,
as everyone here knows, the summer months are the most dangerous. It's not unusual to see weekends of 20, 30, 40 shootings in one weekend, which is alarming. But that particular weekend, as Angela explained, the numbers were historically high. 75 people over 40 incidents, am I right? 40 incidents. Yep. 13 people were killed. What we do know is that around the city there were several gatherings. One happened after a funeral. Friends and family continued to hang out together. After mourning someone, there was an unofficial gathering of a grade school. This is a celebration that happens every year. We talked to a couple different people who were there who said in previous years it's been really fun and a great gathering. And then there were smaller gatherings, maybe 4 to 5 people, so that when these shootings happened, unfortunately and tragically, more people were hit and injured.
So, taking those incidents that weekend, what did you guys set out to do? What was the first thing that you thought that you needed to do to try and understand why this happened?
Well, find people. I mean, our number, I think we set out to try to get on the ground and talk to as many people affected by the violence.
How'd you do that?
Whether they were victims or witnesses, we went to police reports. We went to media reports, anything that was reported immediately after that weekend. We sought out police reports. We used sources. We went to anybody we could to try to find somebody. My goal was just to ask what it feels like to be caught in that kind of literal crossfire. And then what happens next? What is it like to talk to the police about it? What is it like to face maybe going to court, you know, to give a statement?
So in the course of your reporting, there were a number of themes that you guys discovered were at root at some of the issues. I know that one of the things that you wrote about was the difficulty of finding witnesses who were willing to either talk to police about their cases or were victims themselves and didn't want to cooperate. Can one of you tell me about that?
I could start. I mean, some of the themes that emerged for me after talking to people is, for sure, there's a fear of retaliation. You know, speaking up about violence that's happening right outside your door is difficult. We spoke with numerous detectives, too, I want to add, to get their perspective on this. And they acknowledge it, and they told us it's a true thing for them. They understand very often why people can't or won't say something. So that was definitely one theme that emerged for me. Some of the things that surprised me, too, was, for instance, someone who survives a shooting, I asked a couple of them, like, so what would justice look like for you? Will it be if someone is charged and goes to court? And a lot of them said, you know, I don't want to overstate that, but a handful said, you know, I'm so happy I survived. I'm alive, and I kind of want to move on. To me, that provided a different argument about why maybe people don't cooperate. It may not be that they don't want to. It just might be they're feeling like I'm alive, I'm blessed, and I just want to move on.
There was also a resignation we found when we spoke with victims, that especially those who were shot and survived, obviously, in areas of the city where violence is a regular thing. They were just great. Like Annie said, they were grateful to be alive, but there was a resignation where that, they didn't really have a whole like high expectations that their case was going to be solved because it just happens so often. They're so used to, not hearing about, shooters getting arrested for this in their neighborhood just because there's so many shootings, basically.
We did talk to a fair number of people who did not hear from police and who didn't get a phone call. There were not officers knocking on the door necessarily to ask them about that. And one woman in particular that stands out to me was when I called her and she said, well, I have not heard from detectives, she was legitimately stunned and surprised, but yet had a real sense of empathy for how overworked the department is. And she said, I get they have the toughest job in the world outside of teachers. And I understand this, but from where I'm sitting, like, this was a huge shootout in front of my house. There were two cars, three shooters. I think that was the one where there was, like, how many shell casings? The
right,
one on Carla.
Like,
I mean, it was a big deal to her. And she completely believed somebody was going to call her to at least follow up and take a statement. And it's my sense that it was not getting that call that did that, that just created in her mind, like, a big question about whether anybody cares. And I know detectives do care, but what she was, you know, what she was left with was wondering if they do.
Well, you've spent a lot of time writing about the communities. Tell me, can you expand on what Annie's talking about, that impact of not getting the phone call, of the impact of not getting an answer?
Well, I think that the impact is made a little bit worse right now, as right now I think a lot of people, we could probably acknowledge there's been a lot of strain between certain communities and police, and that's for a lot of reasons. I think we were all discussing it yesterday, there's been a lot of turnover in the Chicago Police Department just within the last decade. A lot of new faces, old faces have left. People, cops that people knew were gone, and now you have a lot of new faces. Are those new faces respectful to the people in the neighborhood? Have they made relationships? That's a big question that needs to be ironed out. And with new faces joining the department every time, it's only a matter of time before we can tell whether or not there's, you know, these new officers become the officer that I can trust. If I witness something, will I feel safe going to that officer and telling them and not be worried that the information will come back to the bad guy or bad guys and harm me?
Let's talk a little bit about what detectives are facing. You guys talked throughout the course of your reporting on this about the challenges that they're facing, and you did a story just from their perspective. From the detective's perspective, this particular weekend was they were overwhelmed. The hospitals were overwhelmed. What were they talking to you guys about what they saw as the major issues that keep them from solving crimes?
So just in general, I mean, one overarching theme was that victim and witness cooperation is key to solving murders and non-fatal shootings. I mean, this was also something acknowledged by department brass. It is a very real thing. It is a very real thing for victims to not want to cooperate or witnesses to not want to cooperate for a lot of reasons. But, you know, one of the things that detectives kind of stress to me is that, you know, you're really asking a lot to have them talk to a detective and then go before, you know, repeat their story to prosecutors before a grand jury. And then several years later, when the case goes to trial, you know, they you might not have them being as eager to talk because, they're afraid, basically, of going back to their neighborhoods. That's just one issue. Another issue, too, is, you know, some talked about community distrust more than others. I know one detective in particular, the detectives I spoke with, you know, basically felt that there's really always been community distrust. This wasn't something that happened overnight, but a couple of them did feel that it was exacerbated in the last few years because of stories in the news, like the Laquan McDonald shooting and other, stories about, police, allegations of police misconduct. That's another reason. Another big reason, too, is the caseload. There's one detective in particular I spoke with who said that they feel like they're really documenting cases instead of solving them. And the reason is because when they're putting all their time and energy in a case, they just keep coming in and they just can't concentrate on one thing. There's been a depletion in the ranks of detectives, which is another big reason. 2009, there were close to 1,200 detectives. I think it was around 1,150. In 2016, that was the year we saw the 770 murders. It was around 860. So there was a huge depletion in the ranks, in part because the department didn't offer the detectives exam for years. So you see a lot of officers with a wealth of experience retiring, and then you see newer faces who are promoted. And just even by Superintendent Eddie Johnson's own admission, I mean, there's a learning curve to become a good detective.
Mm-hmm. Detectives also talk to us about technology. My sense was not every detective has the same experience with the ability to quickly use whatever he or she might have, whether it's video from a store or cell phone, a search. They get a search warrant, they can go into somebody's cell phone. So there was concern about that. That has already been at least announced that they're going to address that with technology centers at the area. But that issue was brought up. But when Jeremy was talking, I was thinking about this one detective who told us about standing at a scene and he's trying to decide what to do next. There's shell casings. And he said, he was thinking to himself, God, the offender is probably watching me. And that kind of gave me chills because it just made me think about the proximity of all of this. You know, the detectives are right there, the offenders are right there, the victims are right there waiting for a phone call, and they're all so close to each other. And yet, the cases are not getting solved.
Just to kind of add to what Annie said, too, about the example she gave, I mean, there was one detective expressed to me that, in a lot of these homicides, a lot of these shootings, the police know who they're very confident that they know who did it. I mean, and, based on what I was told, and in, one detective told me, for example, he could think of seven open cases that he has, homicide cases, where he feels that he knows who the offender is in five of those cases. He just doesn't have enough to push that case forward through felony review, through the state's attorney's office to bring charges.
That's a good segue to my next question. Will, you've been in bond court more times than many of the lawyers here today. Let's talk a little bit about the court process. You did a story focused just on how these cases are winding their way through the court system, and you learned some things along the way about how cases might be pleaded down in order to move cases through. Can you talk a little bit about the court process and what detectives and victims are facing?
Certainly. So to begin, learning about it, it just really solidified a lot of things that we would always, I guess, as reporters, we've long known that the court system is jam-packed full of cases. I believe there are about 30,000 new cases each year. and they're all handled by 500 prosecutors scattered all over the county. So you have this abundance, and one attorney told me as soon as you get a new case, it goes to the end of the line. You have at least a year to have to deal with this, and just because someone is charged initially with a very harsh crime that you think will get them off the street, well, then you have to, down the line, you figure out, does this case can be proved? I mean, bond court is one thing when the prosecutors are first making their accusations present, but does the video recording that they say they have, does it really show the defendant? Does it show their face clearly? Is the court going to say, oh, this is inconclusive, this guy definitely did it? It may not. And the person, instead of being charged with shooting someone, like the Rick Franklin case, a gentleman who was caught, allegedly caught on videotape shooting somebody, and they looked at the video and say, oh, it's not so clear cut at all. So instead of being charged with shooting someone, he was only charged with gun possession. And instead of facing 30 years, he now might get out in less than 3 after everything. So.
Regarding that case, too, I think that was one, if I'm right, that the victim did not cooperate. Is that right?
Right.
So that also changes the ability to bring a charge. If you don't have a victim stepping forward to say, yeah, I was the one who was shot, you may not see the aggravated battery charge, which is the common shooting.
Right, yeah. That kind of goes to the misnomer that, you know, so you had 4 cases where there were arrests that weekend, and, you know, just because they're charged with, you know, a shooting, actually 3 of them ended up, one was a murder and 3 were non-fatal shootings. So for a non-fatal shooting, you could be charged, really it's common for attempted murder, aggravated battery with a firearm, if it's established that, you know, authorities think that you're the gunman. But in Rick Franklin's case, the police believe he's the gunman, but they can only charge him with weapons violations. And by the way, he was already out on bail on another gun case at the time of his arrest, too. So that's another issue in the court system.
So when you, in addition to that, you have, well, once this is winding through the court case, well, what's going to happen to it? Is it the person going to go to trial? Probably not. If the evidence is against them, they may decide just to plead guilty, and it would be incredibly intelligent for them to plead guilty instead of facing longer jail time. A retired judge I spoke with for the story says the system couldn't survive if every single case went to trial. You need a large segment of them to say, okay, I'll take this plea deal, I'll be all for a couple of months or a couple of years, and I'll be back fresh, you know.
Some of the work you guys did was on tracking down some of these individuals. There were so many people shot that it took a while for you guys to find even the victims that you could. One of the cases that I think stands out was a woman whose daughter had been shot, but they weren't on the rolls as a shooting. Annie, can you talk about that story and how you interviewed that person and some of the outcomes of the evidence that ended up being lost in the process?
Yeah. This was during the busiest time, right, Jeremy?
7
yeah.
hours.
They called it the surge.
There was a surge period for 7 hours. During a 7-hour period that weekend, there were about 40 people shot.
So she was one of those, and she also was transported to the hospital by friends, which is key, because when she got there, I believe it was the hospital that in true chaos did not notify the department. And so her mother was asking various detectives she saw, are you going to come in and interview her? So certainly losing a week, according mm-hmm. to the experts and some former CPD people we talked to, is not an ideal way to start a case, right? You're a week out. People have left the scene. I suppose you can still go back to the scene, but the interesting thing about talking to her is that when the detectives did finally catch up with her and have a conversation with her, again, I was surprised here. She was gratified. She was happy. And when I asked her, you know, are you worried that this week is going to result in, no charges for your case? She said, not so much that, but I am not sure the detective is going to work very hard to solve it. And I emphasize this is one side to a story. I get it. But what she meant by that was she got the impression from the detective that she knew what happened to her. She might know who would shoot at her. Let me know when you know. And she repeated this to me a couple different times. And the reason that was important to me is because whatever that detective said to her, the way she walked away from that to me matters. Something either got lost in translation or that detective said that to her, and she told me, you know, I truly don't know who would shoot at me. She was not from Chicago. She was in the city going to a party. So in addition to them losing a week, which is not ideal, I also had to think a little bit about that exchange and maybe what they lost there in terms of
trust.
Moving ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes.
So if I could just add a little bit about trust. I think that's, when we talk about trust between the communities, I think it's something that can be earned. But is it? Will the police officers, can one awkward conversation between a victim and a detective? Because sometimes detectives speak very bluntly and they don't know how to, they'll put the the onus on the victim and says, well, you know who did this, so you tell us. But maybe they don't. Yeah. How much damage does this do?
Right. And obviously it makes sense to ask somebody who's been shot, do you know who might want to shoot you? Or did something, it wasn't even so much that I was questioning that line of questioning. I was just trying to understand why this victim walked away feeling wounded, I think.
And didn't this victim also, after a while, Annie, feel that just as time progressed, she just kind of almost lost interest?
Yes. Our last conversation, she said it. She didn't care if she heard.
Well, that's a good segue to, so we've talked about some of the issues here. Witnesses don't want to come forward. They do come forward, they feel like they're not being listened to. Detectives are overworked. It's a busy weekend. They get more cases than they can handle. The court process slows things down. The court process has to go quickly, and so cases are pleaded out. These are all some of the issues that you guys found. Let's talk a little bit about impact. So as you delved further into the cases and the cases stopped getting solved, you talked to a number of people about how this impacted them. Will, can you talk a little bit about some of the cases that you guys did in which people just felt like, it doesn't matter to me anymore because this is never going to get solved, that sort of resignation.
Right. And I think Jeremy hit on it earlier, the sort of feeling in some neighborhoods, not all, that the crime is just such a regular part of life that people just say, oh, it's just these folks being these folks and we don't have to worry about it. They're not going to cooperate. They're not going to do that. That sort of resignation that can exist on both sides, perfectly honest. We've been longtime reporters. We've seen, jaded citizens and jaded cops one another. And maybe they're closer than they believe that they're to be. They're both on the same side, but they just don't give it to each other.
And I think you brought up the point, because Will and I have spoken about this, that, and I've heard you say this yesterday, and it's happened to all of us, is that, when you talk to some of these victims, you learn that this isn't the first go-around they've had. They've had other children who have also been victims of violence who've died, and those cases also aren't solved. I mean, that's a very common thing.
I'll say, in terms of impact, the one comment I heard that also really stayed with me was a woman who, was a homicide, and I had not talked to her for a while. I caught up with her. I asked her for an update. She had not heard from the detective or the department, didn't know really what was going on. And I asked her about that, what she was thinking about that, and she said, the only thing I can compare it to is if you go to the doctor, you take a very serious test, like a life or death kind of test, and you're waiting for the phone call from the doctor. And so every time the phone rings, you think it's the doctor or the detective. And I just thought that was such a great way to remind readers that this matters. You know, that I know the numbers are overwhelming. The number of murders, the number of shootings. I know the department is overwhelmed. But it matters because she's one victim of how many who might be feeling that way.
Annie, you talked to, and this is for any of you, but I know that, Annie, you talked to some moms who, when we talk about solutions, we try to figure out, okay, so here's the problems. What a bleak conversation this is, isn't it? So bleak. But there are people trying to solve the problem out there, and we wanted to make sure that we acknowledge some of that in the series of stories as well. And just a moment here, that the Chicago Tribune has been writing about crime and violence probably its entire history. But in the last decade, I would say, too, that the focus has largely been each year on trying to find a different way to tell this story, to get people to care. And this year, we decided to focus on this one weekend. But in the past, we've also focused largely just on solutions. So we wanted to make sure that was a part of this series of stories. And Annie, you talked to some moms in particular who have been the strongest advocates for the victims, and they are trying to get out there and make things happen. Can you talk about that story?
Okay. A couple of years ago, I met a mother on the West Side whose son was killed, and I spent a couple of days with her. I watched her lead a march. I watched her go to a corner on the West Side, stand outside a business where the shooting either happened or started or there was a connection, and she had a bullhorn, and she was literally calling out, anybody within the sound of my voice, if you saw or heard anything, please say something. You know, she's out there begging the community to help her, and I was just really moved by her drive, her desire. I thought it really put... And it really illustrated to me just a unique person out there in the midst of all this, and they are the mothers, you know, who care so much, whose sons might have had trouble in their background, but it doesn't matter to them. And so for this series, Madeline Buckley picked up the story for us because we were so busy and just did a phenomenal job. She interviewed a couple different mothers from that weekend. I think she tried to call every single one. She found an organization called the Sisterhood that is mothers in the city who all take care of each other. And if I'm right, their kind of takeaway is we just want to know that somebody cares, you know. And I do think the mothers are sometimes the people who push hardest to get detectives and the department to do the work. And I know, Will, yesterday we were talking about another unrelated case where I think mothers jumped in. And
right. It was actually over this last summer, there were two teenage boys who were killed execution style on the far south side in a wooded lot. And we had a reporter, Hannah Leone, who was one of the first reporters there. And over the months, we worked very closely with the mother. Now, the mother... It's so important the roles they play, because sometimes they're the conduits. In this particular case, her son was known as a good kid, so all of his friends would take every bit of gossip that they heard, and they would funnel it to her. In fact, it was the grapevine that let the mother know where the bodies were found exactly. That's how intense the grapevine was. And I recall being in the police station with the parents. The mother was there every week. She made herself a constant presence at Area South. And she's like, we know. We've told you who these people are. You have the names. You know where they are. And the detective was just trying to explain to her as best he could, as much information as we have, we need the right people to talk. We need the people who have this information to come forward. And eventually they did charge these two people who were always provided. But I sometimes have to wonder, and I spoke with you both, I don't know if it would have been done if not for the real diligence of this mother sticking to the case and saying, I'm going to come back every single time. I want updates. I want you to tell me what's going on.
So, Jeremy, toward the end of the year, you got word that the detective division or the Chicago Police Department was going to add a number of detectives to the roles. Can you talk about what they, from your interviews with police, what they hope bringing these detectives on will do?
Yeah, so I had mentioned earlier that in 2016, and this would have been midway through that year, and that was the year with the 770 murders, you had around 860 detectives in the Bureau. And since then, up until now, they've added about 300. So that's already been announced. The other thing, too, the thing they announced at the end of the year was the addition of 50 detective sergeants to the Bureau. So that would bring the total to around 190. And what their function is, I mean, Superintendent Johnson said at the time that it was really kind of unclear where they would be assigned, although he imagined that the bulk of them could be assigned to overseeing homicide investigations and other violent crimes. That obviously remains to be seen. It's a little early in the process. But the goal is that they could better supervise detectives and manage and help manage those caseloads. In my discussions with detectives about how they feel about this, it was kind of mixed. One detective supervisor, for example, welcomes the 50 sergeants because, you know, this person was giving me, you know, just giving me an example that, for example, you could have a homicide sergeant working on a given shift overseeing 50 detectives on the floor, and those detectives don't necessarily work for that sergeant, so that sergeant really doesn't know what cases they're working on. That's mm-hmm. one example. You know, and then you have another example, too, as far as... What was the other one? About the...
Well, I think what other detectives expressed.
Oh, yeah, I got
they
it.
They want to know.
Yeah, I got it. I got it.
Jeremy's got it.
No, the other one was other detectives did raise concern about the 50 sergeants because they want to know more information about where are these sergeants coming from? Do they have investigative experience to build a case? You know, that's obviously another thing that remains to be seen.
And I think that kind of speaks to, after we talked to the detectives, I felt like a lot of what they said to us underscored what we heard from experts, which is, given the numbers in Chicago, what needs to happen is kind of a deep dive examination on about everything. What can they control? Can they fix? We mentioned the technology centers. We mentioned new sergeants. I don't think any of this has been implemented, but they talked about maybe cell phones. Department right. issued cell phones for every detective. Establishing protocols for detectives on here's your checklist of what you need to do. I know most detectives do that, but this is just like a check and balance for those who maybe don't or don't do it well, and have supervisors also work on those lists with them. So I know everyone wants to know, like, what is going wrong? What is the problem? And I do think that this, Jeremy mentioned that we've got outside people in taking a look. I mean, I think it's a system-wide thing. And I'm looking forward to the report, which may be in a month or so, to see what they highlight about what can be fixed.
Yeah, it's the Los Angeles Police Department, University of Chicago, and Washington, D.C. Law Enforcement Think Tank, the Police Executive Research Forum. They've been interviewing a number of detectives in the Bureau, basically to figure out ways to improve things.
I want to make sure we take some time to address some questions from the audience. This is, I think some of these
Before we do that, let's give a big round of applause to our panelists. William Lee, Annie Sweeney, Jeremy Gorner, and a great job of moderating by Angelo Toole. So some questions, please, Angelo.
Great. You get about 2 seconds to read these before you start talking. So I will say I've already seen a mix of what I will say are comments and questions. So this is from Suzanne Malik McKenna, who's a member. Yay for discussing solutions. It's not just gangs, guns, or police response. It's also housing, jobs, mental health, building capacities, and organizations, communities, and talking to perpetrators. So she wants to know, how can the Chicago Tribune and other media not only report, but advocate for answers and solid integrated solutions? Because she believes our power and audience is formidable. I'm not going to let them answer that one. Just as an editor, it's a great question. Like, how does the media have an impact on solution based work? And it's a complicated question because from our standpoint, from the Metro Desk standpoint, the work that we have to do is to shine the light, to ask the question, to get out into the community, to illuminate the problem, to make sure that the people who are most impacted by this violence get their voices heard. That's job number one for us. There are times when we focus our time on solution-based stories. So it's getting out there and talking to people who are trying to make a difference, to examine, for example, studies that, that I've already talked to a few of in the audience today, talking about the kinds of programming that exists in the city of Chicago now. And a great question about programming is, does it work? And it's so challenging to prove, isn't it? It's so challenging to say there's a direct correlation between what I'm doing, what the city's going to spend money on, what the federal government is going to spend money on, and whether that has an impact. And those are stories that we think are important to do as well. But from our standpoint, it's to investigate, it's to illuminate, it's to ask the question.
Can I say
sure.
I won't say anything to
get us in trouble.
I would say, and I know I'm talking to a group of people who care about this city, support journalism, you know, because we can do it and do the stories Angela is talking about with support. So That would be my pitch.
This is from Ted Manuel, who is a Chicago citizen, and he asks, what institutional changes would it take to cure the lag times and speed solving shooting crimes? Institutional issues. You talked a little bit about this already, some dealing with technology. You guys have other ideas about what you've learned?
Well, I think detectives, one thing we didn't mention yet is the turnaround for evidence. I think that's something that people would say, that's a Illinois State Crime Lab issue. That might speed things up. Certainly it would seem that more detectives would speed things up if they can call people faster. But I'm going to hold off on saying for sure that will make a difference until we see a report. Is it supervision? You know, is it protocols? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think institutionally, you know, it's been well reported. I mean, you know, by, you know, the lag time and getting back evidence from the state crime lab. I mean, that's, you know, one possible institutional change, but that's only part of the puzzle in solving these crimes. I mean, it's been expressed to us that, you know, when you talk about... when you talk about like victim and witness cooperation, with a lot of non-fatal shootings, you know what you and I was told it's the vast majority of them. If a victim doesn't want to cooperate, those cases go in. You know, are basically suspended, which means that that's the only they've exhausted all resources in investigating the case, and they have to basically set it aside and move to the next one.
And so this is maybe more of a long-term goal, but I think supporting victims. Supporting people thrown into this process so that they feel comfortable. I know there's often talk about witness protection. I don't know if a formalized witness protection program is what we're after, but maybe more supports for people and to kind of close that gap between the police and the community.
Well, that comes to a question that was asked in the audience. Dwayne Duskins, who's a former federal and county prosecutor, if witnesses are fearing violent retaliation, he asked, death or serious injury, if they testify at trial, what are they doing to protect them? Do you know of existing programs or things and efforts that are being made to try and encourage people to come forward and also protect them if they do?
Yeah. Well, we asked at some point Cook County State's attorneys for a comment about what they do to protect witnesses, because detectives mentioned this to us when we spoke with them after they acknowledged kind of the legitimate fear on the street. And they said they handle things on a case-by-case basis.
Right.
But you were with Kim Fox when she addressed this, right?
Well, Kim Fox spoke about it very briefly and just said that she told us later that it was handled on a case-by-case basis. But, you know, admitted that, yeah, there is no robust, was the word she used, witness protection program. What I've heard on the police end about witness protection is that a lot of that has come in the past from the state's attorney's office, but of course, and I'm sure, you know, and this is an old problem. But, you know, a lot of the time, if you have a witness who's fearing for their safety, what will invariably happen is they will go back to the neighborhood in a matter of time, you know, and you know, obviously, thereby putting themselves in more danger. But they do that because that's really all they know. That's you know, their family's there, you know, despite the very real danger that they face. So that's obviously another issue with witness protection.
And in fact,
historically,
add to that is what the thing that no one really ever talks about is that the people do go back to their neighborhoods, and if they talk, it will come out. It's not something that could be hidden forever if they're going to testify at the trial or if they're the witness that is referred to in court documents. That is going to get out and it's going to come around. What's going to happen after that? Where are they going to go? Can they up and leave on their own? Probably not many can. So these are real concerns that people have to worry about.
And I think that as reporters, we can kind of feel that when we're doing these stories. I mean, we've all knocked on doors where, you know, just a simple conversation with somebody, they don't want to be seen talking to us because they're afraid the wrong person on the block might be watching. I mean, you know, which is a very unsettling thing, you know, obviously.
I have another question from Christina Kenwright from the Wright Foundation, and she asks, what ideas are police departments using or utilizing to try to keep victims or relatives informed of a case? Is there liaison person or technology solutions? What do we know of that they are working to do to try and avoid these missteps of people not knowing what's going on with their cases?
Right. There are those technological sort of events, like if someone involved in your case is getting out of jail, you'll get a notification, you'll get a cell phone call or email. But the sad truth is sometimes the families involved only learn about movement in the case from newspapers. I think we were just talking about this yesterday. Sometimes when I go to bond court and I write about it, and then I'll call a family member and say, did you know this person was in court today? They say, we don't. There's a lot of, there are things that people are trying to bridge the gaps, but there are a lot of gaps.
Just to kind of add to that, well, the police department here has actually made strides with that. I mean, there's programs that are in place where detectives will reach out to families, I guess, every few months on an update in the case, even if it's, not a significant update. If there's, they're doing this through a separate group called Chicago Survivors, where they're basically having homicide victims' families, meet with detectives every few months. I think it's like every third, it's six. I don't know the exact duration, but that's, one thing that's in place. And again, the whole purpose is to establish a relationship with the detectives. And also, again, even if there's, I had one detective tell me that, that's not a practice that he engages in. He said he's basically told families, I'm not going to call you with bad news, and I'm not going to call you with no news either. I'll basically call you when I know something. But obviously there's families that want, round the clock updates, understandably, about what's going on with their loved one.
We have another question from Tony Romanucci, and he asked, sort of a two-parter, and I'm going to go with your second part here. Is Chicago an outlier when it comes to mistrust as a result of the history of police misconduct in the city?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear that.
Yeah, sure. Is Chicago an outlier when it comes to the problem of people not trusting authorities because of the history of misconduct, or is this something that we're seeing elsewhere?
I don't think so. I mean, I think departments like Los Angeles have faced similar problems. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't think it's something unique to Chicago, I think.
No, I agree. It's not. It's.
I mean, we may be having a unique moment right now, right, where it's exposed in a way that never before, and in a very painful way for everybody involved in it. And it is. So that's why, for me, I'm curious to see what happens from that. Like, what will the city do to try to address it?
And I think that it's, to add to that, is we've been hitting on it all afternoon. There have been so many new officers, so many old officers going out, new officers coming in. And I think what we all could probably agree on is that the streets do talk. But the question is, are the streets going to talk to the new officers who are coming in? Are they going to make the effort to hear what is being said and kind of bridge this gap that's going on? And we just don't know.
So they tell me we have time for one more question, so I'm going to take the second part of Tony's question here, which is, are we at some kind of a tipping point in terms of CPD's response so far has been, we don't really need more police officers, and we have enough police on the street. They are adding more detectives, as you guys have talked about, but are we at some sort of turning point here?
I mean, I think that kind of remains to be seen, not to sound cliched about that. I mean, obviously the police department in itself, it's not just the detective bureau they're trying to improve. They're trying to improve the department as a whole. I mean, there's a proposed consent decree on the table. We don't really know how that's going to affect the department just yet. But we've seen evidence, and we saw it in Los Angeles, for example, like Annie was saying, that, you can see big police departments go through these sweeping changes from top to bottom internally and also be successful at reducing crime. It sounds easier said than done in Chicago, because Chicago's probably got the worst of everything when it comes to violence, or among, obviously it's among the worst, but it's... if what's going on in other cities has shown, I mean, other cities have been where Chicago is at right now, and they're doing better. So,
I think we've heard, the last thing I'll say is, in reporting this, the department has acknowledged to us that they know they have a problem, and they are looking at it. So is that a tipping point? As, you know, Jeremy said, we'll find out.
Okay, let's give our panel and our moderator a big round of applause.